So here we are at the end of, you could say, another crazy week in Bitcoin. Two big pieces of news this week. The first thing is that the GDP numbers were lower. At the same time, the inflation numbers were higher. And risk assets didn't really like that. The next thing is, we've had the first week in Bitcoin where we've had 2 days of no inflows to the BlackRock ETF. And as you can see, when you look at the market doesn't really like this. And so we keep going into the sideways range. And the big question is whether we're going to break up or down. I've heard some people say that this could actually be the end of the bull market. But today's guests are telling me that this is not the end of the bull market. In fact, it's the beginning of a 10-year Bitcoin bull market, believe it or not. 10 years, not 4 years like we normally get, but actually 10 years. So today, the show is all about why we could be at the beginning of a 10-year Bitcoin bull market. You like that? Well then, smash the like button and let's fucking go, guys. Imagine a 10-year bull market. Wouldn't that be amazing after all these 4-year bull markets or 3-year, or these 4-year cycles? Wouldn't it be amazing if we just got a 10-year bull market? I'd love that. I just don't know what I'd buy at the end of the 10-year bull market, what I'd do with all my cash. Let me know in the chat what you guys would do with your cash. Anyway, so today it's all about the 10-year bull market. I've got a massive Friday banter for you. I've got two new guests here, both Bitcoin maximalists, but they're going to give us like a big, big, big view of why they think we're going into a 10-year bull market. Just before we get into the Friday banter, I do want to talk to you about a few things that are happening and I think are really, really, really important for you guys to understand. The first thing is, I don't know if you guys saw this, but now the SEC is being sued over Ethereum, and they're actually being sued by ConsenSys. So the SEC is going into war with ConsenSys. Now, why is this so important? Well, ConsenSys is the company that manufactured the wallet that's called MetaMask, and we all use MetaMask. Now, the one thing that could happen when ConsenSys go to court with MetaMask is that in the process called discovery, the SEC may just ask them for a whole list of users, and specifically users using wallets in the US with US IP addresses. And I've been worried about this for a long time. I've been really worried that in the spat between crypto and the US authorities, the US is going to start looking for the US users. And the one way they're going to start looking for the US users was actually by looking at IP addresses. And unfortunately, MetaMask does keep a record of all this. In fact, every DeFi application keeps a record of it. And in the process of discovery, they're going to have to hand over the documents. So I keep saying this. I keep saying that if you're in crypto and you are surfing without a VPN, you're absolutely crazy, because what a VPN does is it hides your IP address. So you can see, like, now I'm not using a VPN because I'm using a company computer, but you can see that this VPN knows exactly where I am. So if I was in the US, it would say US, New York, and give the IP address, and then ConsenSys would have to hand it over. I really believe, guys, that what you should be doing is that you should be surfing with a VPN. Anything you do in crypto should be done with a VPN. As a minimum, make sure that you're hiding your IP address. And it's so simple to use a VPN. It really is. I want to just show you how easy it is to use a VPN. All you do is you decide where you want to surf from, and I'll show it to you over here. Let me just quickly show that to you so you can see how easy it is to use a VPN, because a lot of people are like intimidated, like, how do we use a VPN, etc. Let's quickly just find the VPN. You click which country you want to pretend you're from, click it, and that's where they think you're from. And all this you actually get for, get this, for like $3 a month. Not even, I think it's less than $3 a month, $2.98 a month. Guys, please, we're getting into the final showdown between all the authorities and crypto. Don't get caught out in the last 100 meters of the race. Protect yourself with a VPN. And once you've got a VPN, get this thing called threat protection, because this protects you against those malicious websites that make you think they're other websites and land up draining their wallets. We're going to make a lot of money in the bull market, guys. You want to keep your money, go to the bottom of this video. Click here, click here, click here, pay the $6 a month, support the channel, support our sponsor, and make sure that you don't get caught out. All right, with that in mind, I think we need to get into the action of the day, the 10-year bull market. And I know that this has been a rough week, bit of a terrifying week. I mean, we moved sideways. We got bad economic data for the first time. We got news that BlackRock's ETF brought in zero Bitcoin on a certain day. And it does feel like maybe this is the end of the bull market. Is this the end of the bull market? Let's get the guests in. Let's get everybody. Let's start talking about this. We got two massive Bitcoin guests. We got Fred. We got James with us. Guys, welcome to Banter.
Thanks.
Quite a tricky week. I mean, we had a couple of data points this week which the market didn't like. I think the first data point that the market didn't like was we got economic data, and the economic data showed that the GDP was down, which is kind of what everybody wanted. Everybody wanted the GDP down so Powell could then loosen interest rates. But then that was paired with higher PCE, which means that the inflation, the producer inflation, is starting to go up. What do you make of this data, James? I know you had some views around the data that came out.
Yeah, so I mean, this is just the classic beginnings of what we would see in a stagflation environment, right? So, if we start to see job losses, it will also indicate that we're heading into stagflation. The problem is that with our government spending so recklessly and running up massive deficits at a time when we are not even in a recession yet, that it creates this issue for the Fed and the Treasury that if the Fed lowers rates and tries to battle that the inflation coming down, you know, or it tries to battle the GDP coming down and stimulating the economy, then he could just spur on more inflation. And so that's problematic. We saw this in the 70s and 80s. Fred and I lived it. And for those people who don't understand, it's they're in a position that they just can't win. And so back in the 80s, we saw the federal debt go from like $300 billion to $3 trillion. And so it was up. So this is they're in a pickle. We are currently in that crisis of a debt spiral, and the only thing that can kind of help it a little bit along the way is to allow for high perpetual inflation. But they can't let the inflation get out of control, and we're kind of pressed right up against that. So what does the Fed do? And because the Treasury is just going to continue to facilitate all the spending out of Congress, that's where we are.
Okay, so hold on. Before we go to Fred, if you were sitting at the Fed right now and you were at the position where inflation seems to be sticky, hasn't gone away, the debt is climbing like crazy, the GDP is dropping, what would be your next move as Powell? What would be your next move, and when would you make it?
I would do nothing right now. I would leave rates where they are and just see where the data comes in. Because you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If he lowers rates, inflation could rage, right? But if he keeps them where they are and our unemployment numbers are where they are, which are they're not exactly the way they look. I'll tee Fred up for this one, for the unemployment and the employment numbers. But that's the problem, is that if I raise rates, I could crush employment, I could crush the economy, crush GDP. If I lower them, I could let inflation run out of control. But if I leave them where they are right now, I can get more data in and see if it helps the picture.
Fred, what do you think? I mean, what do you think of this economic data that came in, first of all? We can't hear Fred. I don't know if Fred's muted.
First of all, I agree completely with James, right? So I think we're in this kind of, it's starting to look like a stagflation environment. With the one big distinction between the 70s is that debt to GDP in the 70s was like 30%, right?
Exactly.
And also the other big difference is the demographic mix was a lot different, right? We had a lot younger population, a lot younger workforce in 1975 than we do in 2024, right? So we're an aging population.
And so asset inflation wasn't so important, like houses and such.
Correct. Yeah. Asset inflation was not that important. And the other thing is, if you think about Social Security, right? Everybody, Social Security was not so much a looming problem in 1975, because you had this sort of younger people who were just starting to contribute to Social Security, right? And now we're running into the situation where we have this aging population that's going to be taking advantage of these, you know, mandated entitlements and Social Security. So this is, we've got a lot of headwinds right now think we had in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point. I've heard it described as the pin has been pulled, the grenade has been thrown in the room, because you've got this aging population, right? We have $34.6 trillion of debt. This is a major issue. Everybody knows about it. We talked about it. But another issue that Fred brings up is really important here, is that this aging population is going to start drawing from those benefits massively. And so that pin has been pulled. And so the 210 plus trillion dollars of unfunded liabilities, they're coming due. That check is that check's being cashed. Those are coming due, and we have to pay that. How are we going to pay that? How are we going to continue to perpetuate this by just issuing more debt? You'll have to print more money, because you're going to have to monetize that debt in periods of stress. We've seen it repeatedly over the last couple of decades. We saw it. We didn't see much money printing back in 1998, 2000, but we did see a lot of stimulus and engineered rescues of banks and hedge funds. And so then we saw money printing in 2008.
Well, you could argue that in 2008, the Fed learned that they could print money, or the Treasury learned that they could print money to bail out economies. What you guys are saying, I mean, is what you guys saying that in the short term, we're in trouble, that in the short term, we're bearish? I mean, like, the average viewer here is looking at this and going,
I think we're saying something different, Rand. I think we're saying that in the medium to long term, we're really, really bearish, right? In the short term, things can go on for the next 5 years. You can keep this thing going for quite a while. And, James probably would say we can go a little bit longer than I would say. I'm sort of more in the opinion that we don't have that much more time before this thing just spirals out of control.
What happens until the thing spirals out of control? So when you're both saying, there's a time period, the music can carry on for a certain time period. What happens in that time period, and what happens when that time period ends?
There's two kind of directions we can go here. We can have it where the Fed overstays its welcome and keeps rates high, or even raises them if they see inflation tick up, and we get into this period where suddenly they raise rates and they do overcome that fiscal stimulus that we're seeing because of all the fiscal spending, and we wind up driving ourselves into a recession. If that happens, that's short-term pain, which will induce necessitate the money printing we're talking about, where the Fed and the Treasury have to team up and just provide a ton of liquidity into the market. That's one thing that could happen. That'd be like a V recovery. We saw it in 2020, and that's what could happen. Or we could just go along like we are now, keep spending recklessly, allow the economy to expand kind of in fake GDP terms, allow for high perpetual inflation, and eventually have enough investors demand larger premiums for those rates that are out there in the treasuries, that we wind up spinning out of control with the debt spiral. And we've seen the charts, everybody has seen the charts, and even the CBO puts out these charts, and the Treasury put out the charts about where they think the debt to GDP is going. And even with no recessions and with interest rates staying stable, they're still rising exponentially. And so that's what will happen regardless. The question is, how quick does it happen? Do we have a period of pain and then the recovery? Or do we just go into this long sustained inflation period where we wind up spiraling out of control eventually, and then we have the pain period that Fred's talking about?
Fred, what do you think? So, I mean, how do you see
I think The Fed can do nothing as long as the system holds. But we don't know, and I'm not talking so much about just unemployment here. I'm talking about stocks, right? If we have a major correction in the stock market, you know, the Fed is going to do exactly what it did in March of 2020, right? We've seen print. This playbook, right? Well, print and lower rates, right? So it's not just going to be QE. They will lower rates aggressively, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and furthermore, I would say you really have to factor in the political situation here, right? Because it's not just the Fed. The Fed is not just an entity working on its own. It's the Fed plus the Treasury, right? Now, I can tell you in a Trump administration, what I expect is I expect interest rates to go down very, very quickly.
Yes.
And I expect a new Fed, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it, Trump gets, and we're only 6 months away from this election, right? But Trump gets in, that we are going to be looking at, you know, 2% or less interest rates next year, you know, maybe zero, you know, maybe zero, right? It's, we could completely shift if Trump gets in into a ZERP interest rate. And you know what? Why do I say that? Because Trump says it. Trump himself has said, I want interest rates at zero or lower. Okay. So I think.
But what about inflation? Well, what about inflation? I mean, we have an inflation problem. So, I mean, if we do get Trump in and he gets interest rates to zero, what about inflation? I mean, you have inflation that seems to be back on the upcreep again. So how does Trump or a new administration reconcile this inflation problem with getting interest rates down?
I don't think he cares about it, because he knows that inflation helps the Treasury and their problem. Right. Because high inflation creates higher nominal GDP, creates more tax dollars, which creates the ability to pay down past debt with cheaper dollars. So that's okay. And inflation helps his buddies who have a lot assets.
So why doesn't Biden want that? So, I mean, why doesn't Biden want the same thing? Surely Biden also wants more tax dollars. Biden's building up a deficit every single day. Why do you believe it? That Biden isn't in the camp of saying, get the interest rates down?
Well, I think that Biden's constituents are completely different than Trump's, right? So if you have hardline far-right Republicans who are super fiscally conservative, then they likely have assets and they're going to be okay with asset inflation. Whereas the other side is you've got people who are hoping for there to be enough stimulus that they don't have to work. You've got the what's the word I'm looking for? The minimum wage. No, not the minimum wage. Everybody gets stimulus for instead of working. What's the word I'm looking for?
I know what you're talking about. It's not the minimum wage. It's the
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay, so you brought up politics. Let's talk about politics. I think Biden dropped a bit of a bomb this week around taxes, and specifically around raising capital gains taxes. I guess Biden's thinking around raising taxes and raising capital gains taxes was take from the rich, distribute to the poor. But they were also talking about a capital gains tax on unrealized losses, which, I mean, that sounds absolutely ludicrous. Any thoughts about what the hell's going on here?
Well, my thought is, Ran, is that this is not going to happen. They can't just institute this. But it may be that it's a preparation just to increase capital gains tax, right? So they throw that out there and they say, well, we could do a tax on any unrealized gains. Oh, you don't want that. Okay, well, you'll be okay with a 40% cap gains tax long term, you know. Now, obviously, I think both of these ideas are just horrific for assets. They're bad for all risk assets, right? So they're not good for they're terrible for stocks, but they're also terrible probably for Bitcoin, because everybody in their right mind will take their cap gains before before this law goes into effect. So I think this does kind of would be a very, very bad thing. And it's It might cost Biden the election, to be honest. Yeah,
to me, it's DOA. What I was thinking of is universal basic income. That's the term I was looking for. And so, you know, it's Thursday. It's been a long week. There's been a lot of activity, so my brain's kind of fried. But I think, you know, if you look at ways to fix the debt problem, right, and the deficit problem, and that's what he's doing here, and he's trying to win votes from people who are like, yeah, well, tax the rich, you know, because that they deserve to pay more of their fair share. The issue here is you're talking about taxing small companies, entrepreneurs, and so
on unrealized profits also on, and you're talking about taxing on unrealized gains. That I mean, that is, you want to increase the, you want to increase the capital gains tax. That's a normal narrative that they've been screaming for a long time. But to include into that unrealized taxes, I mean, I kind of see where he's going. We're going to tax the rich to give to the man in the street. But he's stifling business growth in the United States because you're now penalizing.
Do I get to offset my unrealized losses too?
No, don't push your luck.
Here's the problem though. So here's the problem. Here's the issue with it, is that when you do that, when you raise taxes, you wind up disincentivizing more productivity, investment into productive lines of business, investments into R&D and research development to new lines of business, hiring. You wind up disincentivizing that, and so productivity goes down, and so you wind up having higher tax on lower productivity. The issue is that you're in the same place, but it's actually worse because now your production is going down. It's declining. So you're having a higher tax rate on a declining productivity. And so it doesn't work. And we've seen it in history too many times to understand that higher taxes just don't work.
So I want to ask you guys just two quick rapid fire questions. Next interest rate move, down or up?
Down.
Fred, down or up? Okay, so down, both of you 100%. Both of you agree there's no interest rate increase coming because that narrative is starting to creep in. A lot of people are saying, you know, soon the Fed will be forced to raise rates. Next question.
It's a non-zero probability, but I would say that my guess would be down.
Okay. Next question, quick rapid fire question. Who is in the White House next year or this year in December, just after elections? Who's in the White House?
Go ahead, Fred.
I'm going to say Trump.
Yeah, I think Biden's working really hard to lose this election. I'm going to say Trump too. But there's so many uncertainties, and this is part of the problem, is that there's so many uncertainties. We don't know if Trump is going to have a legal problem that he will not be able to actually be elected.
Ceteris paribus, set par. Let's just say that right now, as things stand right now, you're talking about Trump in the White House. How do you see the markets between now and the election? So how do you see risk? When I say markets, I'm talking specifically around risk assets. We're now in, call it May, we're just after the halving, we're in May. How do you see the risk asset market between now and the elections?
Well, it's really hard because what you're talking about is you're leading up to an election that's highly charged between two very polarizing figures, right? And at the same time, you've got geopolitical tension. You've got increasing uncertainty around the economy and around our the inflation. And so there's so many uncertainties between now and then. It's virtually impossible to gauge, you know, so that's the issue that we're talking about here. And you've got you literally have two people up there that 80% of the country would rather have somebody else run than either of these two. And so, and at the same time, they're both in their late 70s and creeping into the 80s. And so, I mean, is Biden even going? I mean, I'm not being facetious when I ask this. Is he going to be physically capable in November? We don't know, you know. And that's it. So it's
there. I don't know if he's physically capable now. I watched videos of him this
morning. You could come up. Yeah. Well, okay, that's fair. And so there are scenarios you can come up with that the election is postponed, or there's, you know, they come up with some sort of new lockdown. Who knows? Like, there's so much uncertainty between now and then.
Fred, what's your view here? So look,
I don't have any strong, even if I sort of think Trump has a little bit of an edge, I don't think he's a shoo-in by any means, right? So I think, you know, it's very close, and I think the bookies are right here, right? It is a very close election.
Think happens to markets between now and then? That's what he's asking.
Yeah. So what I think happens to the markets, I think the stock, well, let's talk about the stock market first of all, right? I think the stock market is going to not like this election, right? So I feel like the stock market could trade down ahead of this election. Not massively, but it might still drift lower, and it might actually have a big problem. But again, we probably are going to have at least one Fed cut before the election, right? If we get one, if we get two Fed cuts, I think that's going to be pretty good, you know? And I think Biden will then paint the picture of we're back, economy's booming, stock market's booming, we were able to cut rates, you know, perfect landing, you know, whatever, right? And I think there's sort of possibility either way, but in the end, I don't think, as a Bitcoiner, I don't think it matters, right? Because like my time horizon is not 6 months. My time horizon is multiple years. And I really think that over a 2-year horizon, all scenarios are great for Bitcoin, right? So, you know,
Tell me why. So walk me through the two year what ifs, and walk me through why all scenarios are good for Bitcoin.
Well, I mean, look, it sort of goes back to now we're talking about Bitcoin, the asset, which is very different, I think, than any other crypto, right? Because yes. I think Saylor made this great video when he was in Brazil recently, right? And, you know, he sort of said, listen, Bitcoin is the largest monetary network right now, right? So we're looking at a network effect where, you know, this asset is growing. This is a network. It's growing like the internet grew, right? It really much is the internet of money. And you know, this thing is growing, you know, and I've put a lot of videos there about this power law, but it's basically growing at this sort of compound rate of something like 40% right now, right? It's slowing a little bit, but it's almost exponential growth that we're seeing, just like the internet in its early days. And if you have 40% growth and but plus or minus, you know, it could go down to zero or negative, and it could go up to 200%. But the end of the day, you're compounding at 40%, and you wait 2, 3, 4 years at 40%, you're going to triple your money, okay, over a 4-year period. That's just the math, right? And you wait long enough, you will go. And so that, I think, is the fundamental bet that all Bitcoiners are going to make.
So you're making a bet. You're making a bet on network effects. That's the first bet.
It is a complete network effect. It is Bitcoin is growing at the fastest rate. Okay. And by the way, I just took a look at this the other day for Ethereum. I said, okay, let's look at modeling Ethereum as a power law. Now, Bitcoin, if you look at it as a power law, it's growing roughly at time to the 6th power since the Genesis block, right? ETH is growing at time to roughly the 3rd power, right? So it's in terms of it, Bitcoin is growing at like the square of ETH in terms of price. Okay, so you can actually model out based on this. You can actually model out what ETH to Bitcoin does, right? And that's that graph you're showing there, right? So you know, yeah,
yeah. So you're saying Bitcoin's growing as a monetary network much quicker than ETH is growing as a supercomputing network. I think that's what you're basically saying. You're saying the rate of growth of Bitcoin.
So it started out because if you're looking at a power law, right, you get this really big growth initially, and then it slows down. So Bitcoin was growing at 200% a year back in 2015, right? But now it's only growing at 40% a year. Well, ETH was growing amazingly in 2016 and 2017. It was way outgrowing Bitcoin, right? But it's now falling, and it's falling faster, the growth, because it started with a lower power. Now, I'm throwing a lot of math at you guys, but that's just the way these power laws work. So if you're looking at something like ETH or Solana and you're like, whoa, this thing came out, it's growing like a weed, it's taking over the world. It does look like that for the first year. After 4 years, however, you notice that Bitcoin's winning. Okay.
Is that because we, as Michael Saylor says, we need a distributed, independent money network, but the need for a supercomputing network that has the same powers or the same properties isn't such a need. Like Michael Saylor's argument.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good argument. Look, there's a lot of different flavors, right? So Solana is a different flavor than ETH, right? But neither of them is really going to take over Bitcoin. It doesn't matter, right? These are smaller things. So,
okay. So scenario one, you're saying network effects of Bitcoin. Network effects of Bitcoin are a good scenario for Bitcoin. What are the other scenarios? What are the other things that are making you super bullish on Bitcoin right now? Like, so the one is you're saying it's got the highest and fastest network effects in the world in terms of a monetary network. We know that when a monetary or any kind of network starts growing, it's unstoppable, barring three forces. One force being government intervention, and I think it's too late for the governments to intervene on Bitcoin. They've just legalized an ETF in what is probably the biggest ETF market in the world. The other one is technological breakdown. We're not getting technological breakdown on Bitcoin. It's been battle-tested for the past 10 years, 12 years, nothing's happened. And the third thing is a 10 times better competitor. But even a 10 times better competitor only has like a 0.1% chance of actually penetrating a network. And so kind of like, I think your bet here is saying on a network effect point of view, Bitcoin wins in terms of a store of value effect. What else?
Look, here's the thing. I fundamentally believe that we're all competing for one thing, world money, right? That's it, right? We had this money for years and years, for 5,000 years, which was gold, right? Then we went to fiat. Now we're going to something else, okay? James and I believe it's Bitcoin, right? Now, there's probably a tenth of a hundredth of a percent chance that it's Ethereum, you know, something like that.
I think right? I think for money, it's not Ethereum. I don't think Ethereum is trying to compete with gold or claims to compete with gold. But I want to ask you a question. So if I'm
looking- They have this whole narrative of ultrasound money, you know, ultrasound- yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying it's correct. You and I know that it's not correct.
Yeah,
but they're definitely also trying to win that narrative.
Look,
the Ethereum guy.
I mean, I've heard that people in the U.S. identify as goats, and then you know they continue. They're goat. It doesn't mean that they're a goat just because they identify as a goat. You know, like I've seen people in the U.S. say that. Like I was on a flight one day. The guy says I identify as a surfboard. You know, and I mean he's not a surfboard. So, you know, ETH can say that they're ultrasound money. They're not really ultrasound money. Bitcoin is clearly the replacement for gold. I'm watching gold, and gold, here it is. So let me get you guys back on screen. So I'm watching gold. Gold is like, you can kind of say nearing all-time highs. It's been messing around with its all-time highs over here. A lot of it is because there seems to be a big demand for gold out of China. And I mean, it looks like to me, and maybe I'm wrong here, that the Chinese investors that used to buy property are now shitting themselves because the property market in China is absolutely collapsing. And they're trying to externalize their assets out of China in the environment of massive exchange controls. And probably the only way that they can do it is by buying gold. And as a result, they've got this crazy demand for gold and they're willing to actually pay a spot premium for gold. I mean, first of all,
it's not just them. It's central banks too. I mean, we made such a tactical mistake, a tactical error, when we shut off and seized Russia's assets, the treasuries. You know, people talk about BRICS, but really the important thing here is that you've got central banks that are trying to get out from under the thumb of the U.S. Treasury and having to own U.S. treasuries in order to have dollars, in order to have cross-border currency transactions. And so what they're trying to do is get away from having to use a dollar. It's not like they're looking for something to replace it. Gold is not going to replace it. They can store value in gold. against currencies in order to make those payments rather than holding treasuries, which they don't know if they're going to have access to, you know? So that is an important narrative. And then the other thing is you can't talk about Bitcoin in this day and age, in this year, 2024, without discussing these new spot ETFs. This is a massive development for this protocol. And the reason it's so massive is that prior to this year, there were many institutional investors who simply did not have access to Bitcoin in a way that made any sense to them personally or professionally. And so Fred and I know this because we've been in the industry for a long time. There were major barriers to entry for institutional investors to get into Bitcoin. You simply didn't have the ability structurally, operationally, to buy, to settle, to hold keys and to have key phrases. Like, you just didn't have that ability to do that in institutions. And now, for the first time, they can just go in and buy it just like it's any other stock. They may not get margin on it.
I agree with you.
They can buy it and settle it.
I agree with you.
Really important development.
Yeah. I agree with you. And I think the institutionalization of Bitcoin and the removing of all barriers of investment from Bitcoin is a massive, massive, massive step. I'm also going to agree with you that I think that the launch of the Bitcoin ETF was the most successful ETF launch in history. Over $12.4 billion flowing into ETFs, 4.25% of Bitcoin's entire circulating supply is currently sitting locked up in these ETFs. But this week, we actually had a few days where we had negative outflows. We also had a day where BlackRock... Is the hype over?
This is normal because you've had this surge of demand from people who are waiting for it. You had people who have IRAs that are sitting there waiting for some way to invest it in Bitcoin without having to go through hoops to buy Bitcoin through an unregistered broker. Now they can buy it right through their Fidelity.
So why are they not buying it?
That was immediate. That's number one. So that started happening immediately. You're barely starting to see the big institutions dip their toe in now. Just barely. It takes about 3 to 6 months for them to go through this kind of a quiet period where they watch the asset and they see how it's performing. They make sure there are no settlement or custody issues with Fidelity, with BlackRock, with Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, whatever, that they're making sure that everything's working properly. And then they'll say, okay, now we're going to approve it. Here's the pamphlet. This is what you need to say to your investors, to your clients. And you've got to stay by the script because we have to cover our ass here. And now they're starting to just barely come out. But the big inflection points are going to be when you see big institutions on Bloomberg listed in their filings as in the holders of these ETFs. And we're just now starting to see that.
Fred, do you also
believe? The other point here is we have this, there's this sort of narrative, right, that fund flows just drive, Bitcoin price, right? And sort of been true to some extent over the first, you know, the first quarter, right, since January 11th. But it is not necessarily the fact that there's also not a relationship between Bitcoin and fund flows, right? So the Wall Street is to some extent a momentum player, right? They're like us. They're like anybody else. They like buying when things are going up, right? So if things take a dip, they won't necessarily sell, but they'll slow down the buying or they'll stop the buying. And that's what we've seen in the last month, right? I fundamentally think that it was not the fact that it was over on the fund side and therefore the Bitcoin price dropped. I think it was the opposite. I think the Bitcoin price dropped and then the funds took a breather and they were like, whoa.
Okay, but hold on. I'm not an investment genius. I just run a YouTube channel and I know that the best time to buy is when the price dips. So not when the price is going up. And these are supposed to be the smart money institutions managing all the billions of dollars in the world. Well, surely
I would say they're not, so I think, how are these people looking at this thing? They're exactly the opposite of a value trader, right? They are a momentum trader. They buy, if Bitcoin
the current Wall Street institutional investors are mostly hedge funds and so and IRAs for long-term investment. But the ones that Fred's talking about is momentum players, because, and this goes all the way back to your question, which was, all right, look, gold is here, Bitcoin's doing this, like what, why are they not in lockstep? Well, part of the issue here is that Bitcoin is still seen, it's perceived as a risk on asset. That's just reality. We know, I know that it's risk off. I would rather own Bitcoin than long-term bonds and 30-year treasuries, but Wall Street doesn't really know that. Institutional investors don't know that yet, so it's still considered a risk on asset. So Fred's talking about the momentum players, and I agree with that. There's definitely some momentum players in here just whipping it around.
And it's not just speculator, right? It's just what these guys are doing is they're going to look at the track record of how did IBIT, they're not even going to look at Bitcoin. They're just like, how did IBIT do over the last 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, two quarters, three quarters, et cetera, right? And if IBIT is the best performing, you know, ETF, they'll buy IBIT. Now, if IBIT has dropped over the last month, they'll be a little less keen to buy IBIT. You know, so it's not necessarily, it's just sort of allocation to this new asset they really don't know anything about. They don't trust. They haven't read the white paper. They haven't read the Bitcoin standard. They don't understand how to self-custody things. What they know is this asset's probably a good place to put your money, but hey, it's risky. Right.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Let's look, we spoke about November, December this year. If I were to say to you right now, 4.25% of the total Bitcoin supply is locked up in Bitcoin ETFs, and I were to say to you, forecast for me between now, this we're now 3 months after the approval. So it was, I think the approval was 10th of Jan, 10th of Feb, 10th of March, 10th of April. Call it, we're 3.5 months after the approval. How do you see the amount of supply, current Bitcoin supply, held by ETFs at the end of the year?
I see it much higher, but... You know, that Double? Has to do with what Fred's talking about is they don't understand it yet. But when the real institutions come in, the non-momentum players, actually the serious investors, as they're able to buy this and they start to dip their toe in, what they do is they'll leg in to the trade. They'll get a 1-3% position in their portfolio, typically just from 0.5% to 1%, and then they'll start doing their research. And as they understand it better, it's my belief that they're intelligent enough to know that this is someplace that they want to allocate a certain portion of their capital, and that will grow. And so that's the point, though, is that the understanding has to grow. And that's when it will start moving away from just a risk on asset to something that it's actually an allocation that's long term in these portfolios.
But so give me a number. Time. Give me a number, sir. 4.25 we are now. Give me a number at the end of the year.
First of all, that 4.25 includes, GBTC, sure. which is a lot early. So really it's about, you know, it's about 2%, you know, a little bit, I'm sorry. It's about 2.5-3% that is just kind of the new ETFs, right? So look, if I had to guess, I think we might get to 10%. It might, right? Like might get to 10%. But I think kind of to James's point, right? I think what we are going to look at, I think Bitcoin's going to do very well this year. It's going to end up, it'll be somewhat volatile, very unpredictable, but it's going to end up doubling between now and the end of the year. Okay, for sure. And I think once we have a good year of track record and we have a new president and maybe the same president, but we have a new, that uncertainty is behind us, right? And we're into 2025. That's really when the Wall Street advisor allocation's really going to kick in, and that's going to just take us parabolic.
You're saying actually exactly what, that we're going to repeat the halving cycle. When you say repeat the halving cycle, generally when we get a halving cycle, when we halve, we then get a period of chop. And the period of chop is usually 100 days, maybe 150 days, depending on that period. And then only do we actually go up into the parabolic stage, which in this case is kind of like a 2020. You know, if we were to follow the halving cycle of previous periods, then we would get that in 2025. You're saying, you're forecasting pretty much exactly that. You're saying, look,
Here's the difference. Here's the difference, Rand. I think, first of all, we've never had a halving cycle where we start the halving cycle at an all-time high. That's never happened, right? And so I think that the cycle that's really important here is not the halving cycle. It's the bull market cycle, right? And I look at this as we are in the fourth bull market of Bitcoin, right? So I think the real big bull markets, you know, you had the market that ended in end of November of 2013, right? That with Mt. Gox. You had the second bull market, which was 2016 and 2017. Right?
Yes.
That's the second bull market. The third bull market was 2019 to 2021 November, right? That's the third bull market. And we are now in the fourth bull market. And we're not at the beginning of the fourth bull market. We're in the third inning of the fourth bull market, right? And this fourth bull market, we're already a year and a quarter in, right? So I don't like to say it just started yesterday, you know, with the halving. It didn't, right? It started, this bull market started at Bitcoin's 15,000, right? That's when this
Bitcoin quadrupled. How long would it last? The fourth bull market.
I think, if you look at the other three bull markets, they've all lasted 3 years, 3 to 4 years, right? Really, if you time it from the low, so let's just take the last one, right? When was the low on Bitcoin, right? It was in kind of end of November of 2018, right? Bitcoin was at 3,500. You and I both remember that very well, right? When that was like, you know, that. So where did it go from 3,500? It went to
69,000.
You know, 69,000. Okay. 69, so we went up 20x, right? We went up almost 20x, right? But we went up 20x over all of 2019, all of 2020, and all of 2021, right? So yeah, 2021 was kind of a flat year net. But it was a 3-year bull market, right? Also, the 2017 market was a 3-year bull market. But really, it started in 2015. It was 2015, 2016, all of 2017. So I think we're in a year and a quarter into at least a 3-year bull market, maybe longer with these ETFs, right? With these ETFs, that thing has a lot of juice left to go. Right.
No, it's huge. I mean, just think about the institutional investors, Fred, when they come in and they're not price sensitive and they say, I just go along, VWAP it, volume weighted average price. I just need to buy, you know, $100 million worth, get me done over the next 5 days, you know, and they'll all go along with each other.
I totally agree, James. And I think, Rand, the thing I think, let's just forget about the halvenings, because your first question was, what about the halvenings? Like, halvenings don't matter anymore, right? They really don't. Like, we're down to like 0.6% of the supply per year. This is not what's driving Bitcoin price at this point, right? Even the guy who invented the stock to flow came out with a tweet and said, guess what? Flow no longer matters. It's only stock at this point, right? It's only demand. So what's going to determine Bitcoin price right now is how much demand is there for Bitcoin, right? Which is, and really over the next 3 years, 4 years, what that is how much demand is there for the Bitcoin ETF? I mean, I hate to be blunt, but that's really it right now. It's like, are these financial institutions who control, you know, trillions of dollars that can be allocated to this, right? Are they going to put in, over the next cycle, are they going to put in $200 billion, $500 billion? You know, what's the number that they're going to put into this market, right? And what kind of multiplier are we going to get? But it's a huge number. And so I don't think that we're talking about cycles in terms of halvenings anymore. I think we're just talking in terms of bull markets. And, you know, look, equities, bull markets can last a very long time, as we've seen, right? You know, the bull markets can rage for a long time. The Japanese bull market, the Nikkei, the biggest bull market I've witnessed in my life, right? And I caught the tail end of it, right? Which was, that market started in 1950 and ended in 1990. It was a 40-year nonstop bull market in Japanese stocks. It was the greatest stock bull market of all times. And the Nikkei went up 400 times from 1950 to 1990. Holy shit.
Wow.
And guess what happened at the end of that bull market? We it took us 30 years to get back to the Nikkei price of 1990. So, you know,
massive housing pop. Yeah.
Yeah. So look, I think with Bitcoin, what I would expect is, number one, we're at the beginning of this bull market. We're at a very beginning of a bull market. We're at the beginning of a secular change in the investor base of Bitcoin. Fundamental change. Everybody who was investing before is very different from the investors now. You know, we are starting to see retail America, you know, Joe Sixpack putting his 401k or IRA or whatever it is, right, into Bitcoin, okay? Or just a percentage of his stock market portfolio. So I think this portends a very long bull market in Bitcoin, and it could last a decade. It could last a decade, this bull market, you know?
It'll come in waves. I don't think it's just going to be one big tsunami, wall of capital coming in. It's just going to come in waves.
But you think, sorry, but I've seen
absolutely normal.
But you think that, so you think that the ETF basically invalidates this 4-year Bitcoin cycle, you know, this narrative? You're saying that maybe not, because we've got the ETF and it's
more accessible. I think it validates it. It's going to continue, and it gives it a little bit extra, you know, juice and maybe a longer period.
What I think, Ran, is that the 4-year cycle, really, it's not mathematically precise. It's like we've had four bull markets, right, so far. We've also had four halvenings, but the bull markets did not actually correspond to the halvenings, right? Because the last one started a year before the halvening. So
yes.
It's... You know, I really just think this causality of halvenings cause bull markets, you know, needs to be reconsidered, because I just don't think halvenings matter that much going forward. I think to some extent, I think the causality that everybody sees is just an illusion, right? And again, look at 2016. Remember the 2016 bull halvening, Ran?
Yes.
Do you remember how much of a non-event that was?
Zero.
I mean, I remember it very well. What?
We didn't talk about
nobody,
it.
Nobody... What?
It was a non-event. It was a non-event.
It was a non-event. Everybody was like, okay, that halvenings don't matter whatsoever, right? And then what happened in 2017? Market took off like a bat out of hell. Why? Why did it take off so much? It wasn't even, the cause wasn't even Bitcoin. It was Ethereum, right? Like, the entire narrative in 2017 was ETH ICOs, okay? You know?
Yes.
And look, you know, and... You know, I remember it very well, because our mutual friend Brock Pierce, you know, was doing kind of, he started the, you know, EOS ICO, right?
$4 billion daily raise ICO. And I mean, huge.
Yeah. You know, so, but look, it was, you know, nobody was talking about Bitcoin in 2017. I mean, honestly, it was like an afterthought. The only thing people were talking about it was, wait a second, this is going to get replaced by Bitcoin Cash, or, you know, like,
I remember that.
You know, block size war, right? So Bitcoin was not, nobody was focused on it. Everybody was focused on Ethereum. And it had nothing to do with the Bitcoin halvening. That bull market had nothing to do. It was coincidental that this thing, bull market, happened right around the half.
But this bull market, you could say, is very much a Bitcoin bull market because of the institution.
It is, but it also does nothing to do with the halvening. Okay,
it
has everything to do with Bitcoin ETFs. If that ETF is not approved, where do you think Bitcoin would be right now?
Yeah, I think it would be back at $30,000. Guys, listen, we are completely out of time. I mean, I'd love to carry this on. Before we started talking, you guys said to me this is going to be a 4-hour conversation. I probably should have known about that. I think we leave here.
Just got started.
Exactly. I think we leave here after like a rough week on the markets, but I think we leave here long-term positive. We've got some great predictions from you guys. So guys, thank you. Much love to both of you. Thank you for first time on Banter for both of you. So thank you very, very much. Thanks, James. Thank you, thanks, Fred. And to the Banter fam, sending you guys much love. I'll see you guys again on Sunday. Remember, we've got a meme coin show on Banter Plus. Very different from this show. We're going to have panels, but they're not going to be talking Bitcoin. They're going to be talking meme coins. Remember to keep farming your gummy. You know how to farm your gummy. You can sign up to Whale School and get the best trading school in the world. There's a link below. You can sign up to Blowfin. You can sign up to Bybit. You can sign up to Evo. And of course, you can farm the points on Banter Bubbles. Also, I'll see you guys again on Sunday. Until then, trade well, my friends.